Bone. This is Lou Caraveli, and you're listening to the Divided Kingdom radio show. Well, here we are in Maryland. Hot. Too hot to my taste for this time of year, although, as a friend said, I can much prefer this to snow. But it was around 87 when I was out not long ago, and kind of came on with a bang without much in between. Sometimes in this neck of the woods is that way. You don't get too much spring. You get winter, very short spring, and then summer. But I think we'll get a little relief from the big heat. Now, what do we have today in the news? Lots of good things. Well, maybe good. We'll find out. Let's begin with this one that appeared in Fox News on April 12th, 2026. Headlined, Fox Catholic Nuns Caring for Dying Patients Fight New York Trans Rule, Face Jail Time. This is by Rachel Del Giudice, G-U-I-D-I-C-E, again of Fox News. Catholic nuns who have spent more than a century caring for the dying poor are suing New York Governor Kathy Hochul, saying a new state law could force them to choose between their faith and their mission, or face fines, loss of licensing, and even jail time, said Mother Marie Edward, OP. We are consecrated religious sisters and have one mission, she told Fox News Digital in a statement. It is to provide comfort and skilled care to persons dying of cancer who cannot afford nursing care. We do not take insurance or government funds or money from our patients or families. The care is totally free. We are supported by the goodness of our benefactors, she continued. We do this without discriminating on the basis of race, religion, or sex. We do it because Jesus taught us that. When the least among us are sick, we should care for them as if they were Christ himself, unquote. Signed into law on November 30th, 2023, the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender and People Living with HIV Long-Term Care Facility Residents Bill of Rights bans long-term care facilities and staff from, quote, discriminating against any resident on the basis of a resident's actual or perceived sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression, or HIV status. That's according to a press release from Hochul's office. The Dominican Sisters of Hawthorne, who run Rosary Hill Home in Hawthorne, New York, filed a lawsuit Tuesday against the law they said would require them to assign rooms by gender identity, not biological sex, allow access to opposite sex bathrooms, allow expression, relationships, and identity practices, use preferred pronouns, require staff training in gender ideology, and post a public notice stating compliance with the law. Mr. Edward told Fox News Digital that New York's gender, and this is a quote, New York's gender ideology mandates not only violate our Catholic values, they threaten our existence with fines, injunctions, license revocation, and even jail time. This is why we were forced to go to court to seek protection of our religious exercise and freedom of speech so that we can continue our ministry to the poor, unquote. A press release from the Catholic Benefits Association said the New York State Department of Health sent the first in a series of Dear Administrator letters to the Hawthorne Dominican Rosary Hill Home, a 42-bed facility, on March 18, 2024. The letters listed New York's demands and included a training curriculum, quote, requiring the sisters to align patient care and the training of their sisters and employees with the state's gender ideology, unquote. If the Dominican Sisters of Hawthorne do not comply, they face fines up to $2,000 per violation, rising up to $5,000. Court ordered forced compliance, loss of licensing, and up to 1 year in prison, and fines up to $10,000. In their lawsuit, the sisters highlighted that during the four-year reporting period from February 1st, 2022 to January 31st, 2026, the New York State Department of Health had received zero complaints from Rosalie Hill Home residents, compared with more than 55,000 complaints against other nursing homes, and an average of 23 citations per facility during the same period. In the press release, Sister Stella Marie, OP, administrator of Rosary Hill Homes, said, quote, "Our foundress, Mother Alfonso Hawthorne, charges to serve those who have to pass from one life to another and to make them as comfortable and happy as if their own people had kept them and put them into the very best bedroom. We intend to continue honoring this sacred obligation, but need relief from the court to do so," unquote. Fox News Digital reached out to Hochul's office for comment and was referred to a spokesperson at the New York State Department of Health, who said, quote, "While the department does not comment on pending or ongoing litigation, the NYS Department of Health is committed to following state law, which provides nursing home residents certain rights, protecting against discrimination, including but not limited to gender identity or expression," unquote. So, as you can see, the state health department just kind of hid behind the wording of this law. Well, we hope they can reach some sort of a good conclusion. Obviously, these sisters, in my humble opinion, should not be forced to go against their religion when they're doing this with no pay out of the goodness of their hearts. But there are those who don't like that because it doesn't fit their agenda. Well, you're listening to The Divided Kingdom, a radio show with a Christian emphasis. We've been doing this now for many years. My late wife, Elizabeth, was really the one who instigated it. And we've been doing it for, I guess, well, I don't know how many years. It's a good many years now. And I'm sorry to say she's no longer with us. A little over a year since she passed from this life. But I know she's here in spirit. Well, what else do we have today? Here's something from the New York Post. Iranian Americans issue chilling warning to the U.S. as they celebrate deportation of regime offspring. This is by Benjamin Brown, April 12, 2026. Iranians celebrating the cancellation of visas for Islamic Republic relatives living luxurious lives in the U.S. have warned the seven deported are just the tip of the iceberg. Shayan, and this is quite a long name, so I'll do my best to pronounce it. Shayan Kost Raymond Fahrenheim, a journalist and activist, praised Secretary of State Marco Rubio for taking action against those who have ties to the regime, that is, the Iranian regime, telling the Post that for too long they've been living comfortably using money stolen from the Iranian people. He said the families of the regime were, quote, using American, unquote, to platform their propaganda, lobby, get educated, and generally live a safe, more comfortable life. On Saturday, Rubio revoked the green card of Syed Issa Hashemi, who is an adjunct associate professor teaching at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. And he's the son of Screaming Mamie. Mary, that's her nickname, Screaming Mary, real name Masuma Ettekar, the twisted propaganda mouthpiece for terrorists who stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 1979, almost 50 years ago, I might add. Hashemi's psychology professor wife, Maryam Thomas-Sebi, along with their son, also had their green cards yanked by federal officials. The family was arrested just days after the Post identified them living in luxury in an Agoura Hills apartment called the Avalon. their arrests come just a week after Hamidat Soleimani Afshar, age 47, and Sarah Nassad Hosseini, 25, the grandniece and niece of the late Iranian terror mastermind, General Qassem Soleimani, were booted from the country after years of lavish living. Ashraven Iftarhani told the Post he spent 2 months working with other activists to gather evidence that was later shared with federal authorities and led to the arrests of both Hashemi and Afshar. He said, "We knew we couldn't do really much about it, just on social media. So we immediately started hitting authorities and finding details about them." Ashraven Iftarhani said, adding that Afshar's own sister shared documents with him that led to her true identity being revealed. And this name is giving me some good exercise here. Ashraven Iftarhani was born in Iran, lived there until moving to the U.S. at the age of 14. He said, "There are thousands more," that's in quotes, "thousands more Iranians with ties to the terrorist regime living in the U.S. who pose a major national security threat." He said, "These people can be sleeper cells, and at the right time, they may get activated. They are really rooted in America, and that is why what the Department of Homeland Security or Immigration is doing to deport these people is so valid." And his sentiment was echoed by Iranian-American grassroots activist Morgan Matizadeh. And he said to the Post, quote, "They are here to influence policy, they are here to steal technology, and that's a national security threat. We are incredibly happy to see that the U.S. is finally deporting these regime thugs and sending them back to the very hell that they built for Iranian citizens." And has a few other things, but that's the main idea there. Again, that is from the New York Post, April 12th. And the preceding article, I don't think I repeated, was from Fox News on also April 12th. Well, you can hear this program, of course. Many of you are now listening to it on WWCR.com or their shortwave outlet, which is found on the shortwave dial at 4.840 megahertz Thursday evenings at 8 p.m. You can also hear it in various other venues on kstartalkradio.com is one of them, kstartalkradio.com. That has many other good programs as well, including some rebroadcasts of older programs by Dr. Stan Monteith. Many of you remember Dr. Stan. He's no longer with us, but he had many, many wonderful guests. So, kstartalkradio.com. And the program repeats on shortwave and on wwcr.com Saturday mornings at 8 a.m. And both those programs are Eastern Daylight Savings Time. Well, the news keeps changing day by day in Iran. As I go to record this broadcast, Mr. Trump is saying that they're going to, what's the right word, block the Strait of Hormuz to all traffic, blockade. Now, just what will happen by the time this is broadcast, I'm recording this on Tuesday afternoon, April 14th. Many of you will hear it either on Thursday, April 16th, or Saturday, April 18th, I guess that would be. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, yes, April 18th. So I'm not going to go into that too greatly because things are changing so fast. I think you could record a program one morning and it would be obsolete by evening, as is often the case with international events of this type. But I will read a little bit of this one article from the Western Journal. This is by Neil Bright, April 12th, and the title reads Iran, Uranium, and Epic Fury, All You Need to Know About the Iranian-U.S. Conflict. I'll give you a few highlights of this. Predictable as death, taxes, yesterday's news, and hoping Trump fails, Democrats can't resist criticizing the military campaign in Iran. Yet when objectively viewing the threatening malignancy of that failed state, all but blind faith progressives could fail to recognize the justifiably epic motivations for Operation Epic Fury. The first such motivation is that since 1979, when Muslim clerics, viewing America as the great Satan, seized power, the Iranian theocracy and its proxies have done enormous harm to Americans. The earliest example occurred shortly thereafter when Iranian militants seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and held 52 Americans hostage for 444 days. And I'll just interject, I remember that very well. And it seemed like Jimmy Carter was powerless to do much of anything about it. I think that Mr. Trump and quite possibly Mr. Reagan might have taken different stances. And in fact, when Mr. Reagan was inaugurated, I think practically the same day the hostages were released, perhaps because those holding those hostages knew that they weren't going to get away with it anymore. But getting back to the article, that longest hostage deal, ordeal in U.S. diplomatic history was followed by the suicide bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, Lebanon, in April 1983. That attack, killing 63 people, including 17 Americans, carried out by Hezbollah with Iranian support, training, and direction, was the first large-scale strike against a U.S. diplomatic facility by Islamist militants. Signaling a new era of attacks on American targets, that bombing foreshadowed an even worse attack by Hezbollah barely 6 months later. In October 1983, Iran supplied the financing, explosives, training, intelligence, and logistical support for the bombing of a Marine barracks, also in Beirut, killing 241 soldiers and wounding 128 others. Undeniably carried out by operatives aligned with Hezbollah, it was the deadliest single-day attack on Marines since World War II. Though another attack by Hezbollah, inspired, supported, and supervised by Iran, occurred in 1996 at the Khobar building complex in Saudi Arabia. It was there that a truck bomb was detonated, killing 19 U.S. airmen, injuring about 500 others. But Iran's proxy killing spree of Americans did not end in 1996. Between 2005 and 2011, Iranian supplied munitions were among the deadliest threats to U.S. forces during the Iraq War. During that conflict, Iran manufactured, supplied, and trained Iraqi militias to use explosively formed penetrators, their most sophisticated and lethal roadside bombs designed to kill and maim U.S. service personnel. Well, it goes on with other examples. Let me skip down a little bit. As if motivations for Operation Epic Fury weren't obvious enough, in retaliation for killing Qassem Soleimani, the key figure enabling the EFP, and the EFP is explosively formed penetrators, I guess, that campaign in Iraq, Iran plotted to assassinate U.S. officials. The Iranian hit list included former National Security Advisor John Bolton, past Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and very likely President Trump. Yet while a strong case can be made for Iran's harm to Americans, the case of the crimes against its own people are greater still. And I'm going to skip down a little bit, but the most epic motivation for Operation Epic Fury is none of the above. The most convincing rationale for overthrowing the current tyrannical regime in Iran is its relentless pursuit of nuclear weapons. That they were nearing that goal, threatening not only the Middle East, but the entire world, is irrefutable. According to the International Atomic Energy Agency, by mid-2025, Iran amassed roughly 972 pounds of 60% enriched uranium. This stockpile far exceeded peaceful civilian levels of enhancement and was fast approaching weapons-grade material of 90%. That amount of uranium, if further processed, could yield enough fissile material for about 10 nuclear bombs. And with no peaceful reason to enrich uranium beyond 60%, which was exactly what Iran was doing, that is the strongest evidence of their intent to create weapons-grade uranium in weeks, not years. Even so, the Trump administration offered Iran many chances to avoid a military confrontation, if only it ended support for regional militias and disbanded any further attempts to enrich its uranium stockpile. At every turn, they refused. And I should add, this is Lou speaking, they are refusing, even at the moment that I give out this, that I read this essay. Well, he goes on to describe what the U.S. was offering Iran. And, of course, they have uniformly refused to accept the offers. And we have to realize, now this is me speaking, not the essayist. These are religious fanatics, these mad mullahs they're sometimes called. But it's no joke. I don't think there's any question that if they had the ability, they would nuke American cities. And if we don't do anything at all, they'll have that ability in due time. And they are motivated by religious fanaticism, which doesn't really care what happens to their own people. They just want to get back perceived injuries from the West. Well, enough of that. I think everybody who thinks about it realizes that all of that's true. Now, let's see, what else do we have here? Well, we have a little bit more about COVID. COVID never seems to totally go away. Some people are still catching it. It doesn't seem as bad as it used to be. I tested positive last November. Didn't really get that sick from it. But many of you remember Al Cuppett, who was on with us several times. He was a distant relative. My wife's maiden name was Phoebe Elizabeth Cuppett. And Al was a distant relative. He grew up in the Western Maryland County, Garrett County, lived for quite a time in Prince George's County, where I taught for many years and lived for some of those years. And he was a action officer for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, high-ranking guy in the American military. And sad to say, he did pass away from COVID. He may not have gotten to the hospital quite fast enough, but it's hard to say. He was in his mid-80s, time when we are all, if we live that long, going to be more susceptible to infections. But I do think that COVID has become less deadly as time has gone on. Now, why do I bring that up? Because we have an article from Zero Hedge. Very interesting website. If you've never visited that, zerohedge.com, well worth going to. There's a lot of business news, but it's not limited just to business news. This one says, the title, Biden FDA knew about COVID vaccine stroke risk and kept Americans in the dark. This is by one of their chief officers, Tyler Durden, Monday, April 13th, 2026. If I record this, that's just yesterday, so it's quite up to date. Senate investigators spent months reviewing roughly 2,000 pages of federal records. What they found is damning. FDA and CDC officials under the Biden administration identified a significant stroke risk tied to Pfizer's COVID-19 bivalent booster in seniors, and never breathed a word to the public. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin, chairman of the Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, sent a formal letter to HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., laying out the evidence. He wasn't speculating. He was citing the government's own files. Johnson wrote, quote, HHS records show that as early as October 2022, federal health officials identified a potential connection between the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 bivalent booster and ischemic stroke for individuals over the age of 65, unquote. An ischemic stroke means a blockage of blood to the brain. Between November 2022 and March 2023, seven separate analyses of incoming data flagged the same stroke signal, specifically in adults over 65. CDC data cited by Johnson shows 226 stroke cases reported between August 2022 and February 2023, with additional cases surfacing throughout 2023 and 2024. Despite the risk, the Biden administration issued no warnings, no health alert network message, no changes to booster recommendations for seniors, nothing. Instead, in February 2023, HHS quietly hired a private contractor, Glucose LLC, to conduct a deeper internal investigation dubbed the Stroke Project. Publicly, officials kept insisting the vaccines were safe. And here's a quote from Mr. Johnson, Senator Ron Johnson, that is. From the initial detection of the safety signal in late 2022, health officials continued to say the vaccine was safe while simultaneously searching for evidence to support that assertion, Johnson said. Gets worse. Federal officials drafted a communications plan about the stroke risk that included a, quote, tough questions and answers section prepared for President President Biden and his White House team. During final edits, the description of the stroke signal was quietly changed from moderately elevated to slightly elevated. Who made that change? Nobody knows. The language softened. The edit went unattributed, and the public remained in the dark. The pattern is consistent. Senate investigators previously established that Biden officials also downplayed the risk of vaccine-induced myocarditis and kept that from the public. This wasn't a one-time failure. It was a system. Here's what makes this cover-up even more infuriating. The Biden administration showed it was more than willing to pull the plug on a vaccine when it wanted to. In April 2021, officials paused the Johnson & Johnson Janssen vaccine due to blood clot concerns. The controversial move was pitched as proof of the administration's commitment to safety. At the time of the pause, six cases of severe blood clots had been reported out of nearly 7 million doses administered. So in 226 stroke cases surfaced tied to Pfizer's bivalent booster in the most vulnerable seniors, the same administration did nothing. That double standard wasn't accidental. It was deliberate. The fallout from that kind of institutional betrayal is hard to overstate. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, fewer than half of all Americans now trust the CDC and FDA to operate free from political or special interest influence. That was from ZeroHedge.com by Tyler Durden, Monday, April 13th. Well, I must admit, even before Elizabeth and I wrote our book, COVID and Coming Chaos, we didn't trust what the government was saying. We've heard too many stories. We've heard from people that have got the shots, including some relatives, and got COVID anyway. The so-called vaccine didn't protect you. Of course, the government claims that, it didn't stop the disease, but it made it milder. But who can say? Obviously, it's not just the vaccine that made it milder, because those that didn't get the vaccine have had much milder cases of COVID. A lot of that might be due not to vaccines, but to what they call herd immunity. Well, I may have a couple more books left. I think I do have about two left besides my own copies. If you'd like to get that book, it'll be first come, first serve. I just simply don't have the money anymore to have more printed, but I will be glad to mail them out to anyone who writes to me. It'll, however, have to be first come, first serve. So get your letter in the mail quickly. Write to me, Lou Caroy. That's C-A-B as in Victor, E-R-L-Y. And the address is Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. That's Lou Caroly, P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And I will write back to you. Hopefully, I'll be able to send you the book if they're not all gone by that time. If not, I'll just say I'm sorry, but the whole supply is used up. But thank you for asking. Well, I got my taxes done. And that is to say, I mailed the federal income tax. That was not the biggest trouble. Maryland has a very complicated, to my way of thinking, income tax. I have one of the simplest situations possible. I have no sizable bank interest. I have no investments. I have a pension. And I have Social Security. That's all. And yet, the Maryland return used about, I think, 8 sheets of paper, some of them on both sides. The basic form is much more complicated than the federal income tax. And tomorrow is the deadline, April 15th, as I'm recording this. Have I mailed the state one in yet? Nope. This morning, twice, I found new little details in the fine print that I had not yet taken care of. Another 4-page form had to be run off from the state's website, and I hope I got them all. It's for a measly return of about $100. I'd almost give it up, but then again, they might charge me with tax evasion if I did that. So I've got to mail it. I'll mail it tomorrow morning. I know tomorrow's the deadline. Yes. Tomorrow's April 15th. And this is the first time, by the way, that I've gotten a refund in a long, long time. Some of that is because Elizabeth is no longer with me. She passed away a year ago in February. And some of it is the Trump changes in the tax laws, which benefit some of us older folks. It's one particular thing that was a great help to me. Well, next year, I'll have to claim it as a single person. I could claim it a joint return this year because Elizabeth passed away in the year 2025. And of course, these tax returns are for 2025. So that's a good thing to get done. Now I can concentrate on cleaning the house and doing some more ordinary things. Well, what else do we have today? By the way, you might want to check out our website. I have yet to do any essays. I keep saying, I keep saying I'm going to put some more essays in, and I never get it done. But if you just want to look at some of our past essays that Elizabeth wrote and I wrote, go to our website, DividedKingdomRadio.com. DividedKingdomRadio.com. You can see a tribute to Elizabeth that I wrote not too long after her death. You can see those essays I spoke of on many different topics. You can go to the archives and listen to any old programs. And you can also check out other venues for listening to our program. So, DivinerKingdomRadio.com. Check that out. Now, what else do we have here? Here's something from Fox News. Gabbard, that is Tulsi Gabbard, claims, quote, coordinated effort, unquote, by intelligence community to advance narrative to impeach Trump. This is referring back, of course, to Mr. Trump's first 4 years in office when he was impeached. Was it twice? Because the Senate did not remove him from office. I think the senators realized, at least someone realized quite well, that this is politically motivated. This appeared in Fox News on April 13th, written by Peter Benito, or Benito. I'm not quite sure which is the proper pronunciation. It's P-I-N-E-D-O, Fox News. And it says, National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard addresses her Justice Department referral and declassified report of former President Barack Obama's for his role in manufacturing and politicizing intelligence on the 2016 election interference hoax. Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, released newly declassified testimony that she alleges showed a, quote, coordinated effort, unquote, by the intelligence community to manufacture a conspiracy used as the basis of President Donald Trump's first impeachment. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence on Monday released two declassified transcripts from closed-door House Intelligence Committee hearings that Gabbard's office says show former intelligence community Inspector General Michael Atkinson advanced as credible a whistleblower complaint based on secondhand information from an individual who had previously worked with then-Vice President Joe Biden in Ukraine. Gabbard's office argued that, based on this and other testimony, Atkinson's actions, quote, weaponized the whistleblower process and exceeded his statutory jurisdiction, unquote. Atkinson's investigation helped trigger the first impeachment of Trump by advancing what he deemed a, quote, credible, unquote, whistleblower complaint regarding a July 2019 phone call between the president and the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. And I'm going to skip down some of this, just minute details, but not all that interesting. Gabbard, citing previously classified House testimony by Atkinson, said the former Inspector General, quote, aggressively advanced, unquote, his preliminary probe by relying on secondhand testimony and what she described as politicized witnesses. Gabbard's office also chides that Atkinson, quote, never conducted a formal or complete investigation. And according to the statement from Gabbard, this is in quotes, in his own words, IG Atkinson recognizes that his conclusions were based on a preliminary investigation, noting that, and this is in quotes, I haven't done an investigation to determine what they actually, in fact, took place. That all of the alleged actions actually took place, according to the statement by Tulsi Gabbard. Under federal law, the Inspector General's preliminary role is to determine whether a whistleblower complaint appears credible, rather than to fully investigate or substantiate the underlying allegations. Atkinson did not immediately respond to Fox News Digital's request for comment. The testimony reveals that Atkinson was aware that the primary whistleblower, whose identity has still not been officially disclosed, was a, quote, registered Democrat, unquote, and had alerted staff on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence before submitting their, quote, disclosure of urgent concern form. Gabbard's office says. Well, the rest of this article is somewhat technical in legalistic terms, But let me look down and see if there's anything else of great interest. Gabbard's office said that one of the key witnesses, and the word key is in quotation marks to emphasize it, one of the key witnesses Atkinson relied on to corroborate the whistleblower's report during his preliminary investigation was also a co-author of the controversial 2017 Intelligence Community Assessment on Russian Collusion that Gabbard has previously said was instigated at the direction of former President Barack Obama. Gabbard herself, a former Democrat, accused Atkinson of having, quote, failed to uphold his responsibility to the American people, putting political motivations over the truth, unquote. And at the time, it certainly seemed that way to me. Of course, Democratic lawmakers largely dismissed the disclosure from Gabbard, framing this declassification as an attempt by the DNI to win favor from Trump. And give some of their criticisms. Well, again, that was from Fox News and appeared on April 13th, just yesterday as I record this. Now, it seems that certain topics in the nation's history never go away. One of them is the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And some people will say that's ancient history. And for many Americans, it is. I would say probably the majority of Americans were born after that happened. But a few of us old codgers are still alive and remember all too well the day it happened. I was in high school. I was in a study hall somewhere around, I suppose, around 2 o'clock Eastern Time, up in Massachusetts, when the vice principal came on the intercom and said, we've heard, I guess it was on the radio, they must have had the radio playing in the school office, that the president has been shot in Dallas. Well, it took me a few minutes to digest that. Does he mean the school principal? And then finally registered, no, he means the President of the United States. And, of course, this was the first assassination since William McKinley. There had been other attempts on Franklin D. Roosevelt, on Harry S. Truman, but the last successful assassination of a U.S. president before Kennedy was way back sometime around 1900, give or take a year, and Teddy Roosevelt was then sworn into office. Well, this one says, and this appeared in Yahoo News, quoting from the National Enquirer, new video of John F. Kennedy's assassination could prove there was a second shooter involved, by Mark McGarry. Now, why does this continue all down the decades to be a subject of interest? Maybe because the original investigation was so poor. I remember when the Warren Commission came out, and like most Americans, I thought, yep, this is the last word. This tells exactly what happened. Lee Harvey Oswald fired 3 shots from the 6th-floor window of a building called the Texas School Book Depository in a park called Dealey Plaza in Dallas, November 22nd, 1963. That date is etched in my consciousness, just like December 7th, 1941, the day of Pearl Harbor, was etched into my dad's and my mother's. But why the controversy? Simply because it didn't take long for the evidence to start to come out. And here the evidence is not some flaming left-wing conspiracy theorist. The evidence is what the government published themselves in 26 volumes of hearings and exhibits that was put out a few months after the Warren Commission report. Now, the report put out, I believe, in either September or October of 1964, not quite a year after the assassination, said As I just mentioned, that all the shots were fired by Lee Harvey Oswald from the sixth floor window in that Texas School Depository, a warehouse, that Oswald acted alone, that 2 days later he was shot and killed by a nightclub owner, Jack Ruby, who was sympathizing with Jacqueline Kennedy, didn't want her to have to come back to Dallas for any kind of trial, so he figured he'd end things himself. Well, from the beginning, most Europeans who were more used to conspiracies than we are in America thought, that is pretty suspicious. It looks like an attempt to eliminate Oswald before he could talk. But it didn't end there. As I say, the 26 volumes very quickly showed that the opinions about Oswald were not unanimous. There was a great deal more to Lee Harvey Oswald than they portrayed in the original news broadcast. He wasn't just a loner. He wasn't just a malcontent. He was also a man who had a security clearance at the secret U-2 base in Japan when he was in the U.S. Marines. He had dealings in Mexico, in New Orleans. His uncle was an associate of one of the main gangsters in New Orleans. A lot of things were going on. So now, this article says, and I'm going to criticize some of it as I go along, because some of it is not entirely accurate. I've got a lot of books on the assassination. I've read a lot about it. So I have some degree of confidence in talking about it. This appeared, I believe I said, on February 19th, 2026. So it's a couple months old, but it's still relevant. And it says, key takeaways, powered by Yahoo Scout. Well, that's a little advertising there. Let's see now. The summary says, Orville Nix's 8mm film of JFK's assassination, showing a shadowy figure on the grassy knoll, has been missing since 1978, sparking a legal battle with the U.S. government. Now, Orville Nix is not as famous as Abraham Zapruder. Abe Zapruder, a dress manufacturer, had a new camera that he almost didn't bring to the president's motorcade. It was rainy when he got up, and so he left his new camera at home, new movie camera. And one of his workers said, Mr. Zapruder, you need to go home and get that camera. And he jokingly complained a little bit, but he did go home and get it. Otherwise, that would never have been a recording for history. Zapruder was not too far away from the president. He was on the president's right side of the motorcade, had a good view, except for one small short period when the president's limousine disappeared behind a fence. Not a fence, but a sign, road sign. Other than that, he had a good view from the time the president came into view on Houston Street as he turned down to the fatal point on Elm Street. And, of course, the Zapruder film shows the fatal headshot. Now, Orville Nix was on the opposite side, the left side of the president's motorcade. And he had a view of what was called the grassy knoll, which is not much of a hill. It's just a little rise on the edge of a railroad overpass over the roadway that the president's motorcade was following. And the article says a grainy 8mm film allegedly hidden away by federal authorities for decades could blow the lid off the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and prove there was a second shooter on the infamous grassy knoll, the National Examiner can reveal. I may have said National Enquirer earlier. I guess it was the National Examiner. Dallas air-conditioned repairman Orville Nix shot the remarkable footage on that fateful day, November 22, 1963, in Dealey Plaza. The film captures a startling image of a shadowy figure lurking behind a fence on the knoll, the very spot where many witnesses reported hearing gunfire, per New York Post. And it shows a diagram made by the autopsy physicians the night of the assassination that has always been a controversy because it shows a bullet wound several inches below the president's collar line. This is kind of a schematic drawing of the president's body. If the wound really was there, and that's where the doctors put it, there's no way Oswald could have been firing from that sixth floor window and hit the president there and yet have the bullet wound in the neck higher up. Oswald would have been firing downward. You can't have the bullet go down and then zigzag back up again and come out the president's throat. Can't happen. So that's another one of the controversies that's gone on down through the years. Getting back to the article, while the infamous or famous Zapruder film shows the instant JFK was struck in the head, Nixon was positioned across the street, aiming his camera directly toward the grassy knoll. His footage includes a clear view of First Lady Jackie Kennedy climbing onto the back of the presidential limousine, with the fence in the background. The original first-generation film has not been seen since 1978, when it was sent to a Los Angeles company for analysis, and was allegedly seized by federal authorities, who now claim they no longer possess it. Oswald Nix died in 1972, but his granddaughter, Linda Gail Nix Jackson, has filed court papers against the U.S. government seeking to recover the missing film. She claims it could be worth as much as $900 million because it may prove once and for all that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone in the assassination of JFK. A judge has ruled her lawsuit may proceed. The government insists it doesn't possess the original film. So, I'll interject here. Apparently, films that have been shown since then are poorer quality copies, not the high-quality original. So that's where the controversy lies. Over the past six decades, back to the article, Nixon's footage has reportedly passed through the hands of the FBI, UPI, United Press International, Congress, and the Aerospace Corporation, the Los Angeles firm that says it returned the film to the National Archives after completing its analysis. The historical value of the footage could be incalculable. May bolster the findings of the 1978 House Select Committee on Assassinations report, which concluded that JFK was probably assassinated as a result of a conspiracy. And says Scott Wetnick, an attorney for Jackson, Nix's film is really the only one known to have captured the grassy knoll area of Dealey Plaza at the moment the assassination occurred, unquote. Modern technology could dramatically enhance the footage's clarity, adds Wodnick. We could certainly reveal details that were impossible to detect when the committee examined the film in 1978. Well, that's just one of the many reasons the whole subject has remained a great controversy. Numerous books have been written. I think I must have at least 30 books on the assassination, and I only have a small fraction of what's out there. New books are put out every year. You would think that after 63 years, going on 62 years going on 63, the whole topic would be dead, much like the Lincoln assassination. But no. The original inquiry by the Warren Commission either was superficial by accident or incompetence or on purpose. It's no accident that Lyndon Johnson appointed Alan Dulles, former CIA director, to be one of the lead ones on the commission. And he used his influence, it's quite clear now, to direct it away from any thought that there might be a conspiracy. And we could go on and on and on for this topic, but I don't want to bore you to death. I may have already done that. One other article I'll give you the headline about was in Axios, in case you want to look at it. And the title of that article says, Scoop, Secret CIA Report Boasted About Tricking Congress and JFK Probe, Whistleblower Says. This came from last November 19th, 2025. Just read the introductory paragraph. A CIA whistleblower revealing his identity for the first time tells Axios he saw a secret document in which an agency official bragged about misleading congressional investigators about Lee Harvey Oswald's activities in Mexico before President Kennedy was assassinated. Now, once again, that's a can of worms. Lee Harvey Oswald went to Mexico City about a month before the assassination took place. What he did there, to this day, remains unknown. Supposedly, the CIA took pictures of him, but when they released the pictures, it clearly was not Oswald. It was a husky man who looked nothing like Oswald. Oswald was skinny, receding hairline, nothing like him. And this does identify this man. So it's not some anonymous guy. It's former CIA State Department historian Thomas L. Piercy, tells Axios. But no, I take that back. I don't think that is the person. That's the person who's reporting to Axios. Well, it's an interesting topic, and we could go on and on and on. Many people have devoted their lives to investigating this, feeling that terrible injustice was done, letting the real perpetrators go free, and after his death, basically framing Oswald. Oswald may have hit a part in the conspiracy, but most people think he did not have the ability to shoot a moving target with a very inferior rifle. And in fact, government investigators could not duplicate what he did. So, we'll leave it at that. One little article, we're just about out of time, but from Fox News, California fraud concerns ramp up as man pleads guilty to massive scheme using taxpayers as his piggy bank. Well, that sounds pretty interesting. That was by Andrew McNoah. If you want to check it out, Fox News, April 8th, 2026. And I believe I hear our music coming on. I want to thank you all for listening. Check out our website once again, UnitedKingdomRadio.com. And if you'd like to contact me, we could always use some contributions. They've kind of fallen off lately. Just barely having enough to pay for the program. So if you could help us out a little bit, that would be great. Write to me at Lou Caverly, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Thanks again for listening. Tune in again next week. Good night.